What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows.
This is Breakthrough News, and it is election night 2024 here, November 5th. It is the big night, as it were. I'm one of your hosts here, Eugene Perrier. I'm alongside, as you can see, Katie Helper, The Katie Helper Show. A big shout out to all of our audience watching on The Katie Helper Show YouTube. And of course, my regular Freedom Side co-host, Rania Kalik, also with us from Dearborn, Michigan. Ladies, happy to be here with you this evening.
Thanks for having us.
We've got voices from all across the political spectrum, but for sure, this will be the only place I think you'll be able to find tonight where there's going to be, you know, any significant coverage of the issues that are really facing people here in the United States and the issues that are really facing us here in this election. Obviously, it's a huge election. There are so many issues, you know, a cost of living crisis. We've got 155 million people, according to the Census Bureau, having at least some trouble making expenses meet week to week. An ongoing genocide in Gaza, well over 40,000 people killed, over 100,000 injured, thousands killed in Lebanon, expansion of a war all across West Asia, in addition to the wars that are raging in Ukraine, the proxy wars and potential cold wars that are raging across Asia. So there's, you know, issues like that. Immigration, of course, one of the biggest issues that is facing us here in the United States. I don't want to go on and on. Climate change, there's so many issues. We've got a few minutes until our first guest. Maybe, Katie, I'll start with you since you're to my immediate right on my screen. I don't know if how it looks to other people there. Maybe
not
initial couple minutes about how you're feeling. What's going on? Election night 2024.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really depressing night, obviously. I think that, you know, all the issues that you just brought up, Eugene, it's really important to remember and be mindful of. And, you know, tonight we have an election between two genocide dares, and one genocide dare is going to win. And I think even people who really feel, I mean, there are people out there, there's a range of opinions, but I think that even people who really want to see Trump defeated and feel like celebrating should not celebrate. I think that's really important to do. I see a lot of people, and people have the right to see this election the way they want to see it. But I really think that no matter what, we are just choosing between two mass murderers. And I understand people have different arguments about who will be less evil, but tonight is not going to be happy no matter what happens, because tomorrow the genocide continues. And we need to remember that and make sure that we're not distracted by this election and that we work harder than ever to make sure to stop the genocide. And I'm also, apologies, I'm sick. This election is making me sick, literally. And the state of the world, I think, is making me sick. But that's really all I have to say, is that we have to not see this as a distraction. This has to be brought into the context of what is happening right now. And that is a genocide and an expanding regional war that could lead to, honestly, world war, if we're not careful.
Yeah,
that's my optimistic take.
Well, the fear of war is definitely important. Rania Kalik, some of your initial thoughts.
Yeah, so my apologies. There's just a lot of people around me. I am actually at a watch party at a local Dearborn restaurant called The Canteen, where the ADC near me has a big stage and they're following the results. A lot of people from the Arab community are here.
And the ADC, for people who don't know?
The Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, who run by Abed Ayoub, who we've had on this show before. But it's been a really interesting few days. You know, me and Kate Pritzker and are here with our cameraman, Craig, who's standing right in front of me. And we've been doing a lot of coverage here that I'm sure a lot of our audience has seen. And, you know, one thing that's been very apparent is that everybody I've spoken to here has been touched in some way by the genocide in Gaza and the escalation across Lebanon and the constant bombing of Yemen. Their families are being killed. Their houses are being destroyed. I mean, just everybody has stories of loss. And they feel the Democratic Party almost across the board has abused and insulted them in terms of the way they've ignored them or justified the violence being perpetrated against them. So it's really radicalized this community that obviously in the last 20 years has been a very strong voting bloc for the Democratic Party. In Dearborn, Michigan, where I am, has the largest, I think, Arab American community in the country. So obviously Michigan's a swing state. I have really found it so difficult to find a single person who says that they voted for Democrats here, or at least maybe they're not willing to say it publicly because it's almost like an embarrassing thing to say. A few people have endorsed Trump, but not many. But the point is that I find it very difficult to see the Democrats winning this state, given how angry this community is. And they really have been radicalized by the horrors inflicted across the region. Everyone here is completely traumatized. They spend 24 hours a day from when they wake up to when they go to bed looking at the news to see where's been bombed, if their houses are still standing, where their families have been displaced to. It's really just completely horrifying to witness. So, yeah, I think it's actually going to possibly determine the outcome of this election.
Yeah, well, we're certainly going to have to see there. 8 o'clock, the polls are just closing in Michigan, only about 2% of the votes in, but we'll continue to bring that. About 5% in Pennsylvania, 30% in Georgia. So some of the states will be watching closely where this will all be a factor. Pennsylvania, of course, Puerto Rican voters will all be a factor as well. You know, Katie, we're going to jump in there. I just want to note really quickly, this is also an election that has to be framed and discussed in the context of big money. For just one small piece of it, 150 billionaire families have donated basically $2 billion to races up and down the ballot. So that's something we'll be able to talk about all night long. But the influence of big money, you know, a huge factor in this. Katie, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to really pay homage to Rania Kallik and all of you at Breakthrough News because, you know, Rania did amazing coverage. And it is stunning to me that Rania is unique in this because we've seen so many pundits talk about Arab Americans and about their feelings and how they're going to vote. And Rania stands out in actually talking not about them, but to them. And it really shows you how the poverty of our media, I mean, how disgusting it is that these people are not worthy of literally voicing their own views. They're only worthy of being spoken about. I mean, during the I think I saw like Face the Nation did one panel with Arab Americans, but, you know, the invisibilization and erasure of Arab Americans is something that we see reflected, obviously, in our policy, political policy, but we really see it in the media. And, you know, something like this, when it comes to foreign policy, media is more important than ever because it's really the only way that people who don't have family abroad experience at all what's happening. And the misinformation and disinformation out there is so rampant. And that's why I think independent media is so important. And again, I really recommend that people watch these interviews. She had, Ronnie, I really loved your like debate kind of town, almost like informal town hall. And what's so fascinating also is that, I'm sorry, I have this frog in my throat, but you know, there was a variety of opinions, but everyone was so smart about it and so sharp and analytical. And I think there's such an attitude of, condescension towards Arab voters as being like one issue voters. And you got a lot of people being like, why aren't they talking about other things? And already like preemptively blaming them for a Trump victory. And these people are so much smarter than all the people who are talking smack about them. So I highly recommend it.
Well, let's go to our first guest who we have here on, who I think it may be in Michigan herself right now, the Green Party presidential candidate, Dr. Jill Stein. Jill, as always, thanks for joining us.
It's really great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me on. Yes, I'm in ground zero for the political rebellion right now, and it's really awesome to be here in Dearborn.
Right on. Well, and you say that is exactly where I want to open. You know, you've been running this campaign for a number of months now. I mean, what are you hearing from people on the campaign trail? What is missing in the two-party system that you think is attracting people to your campaign and other third parties?
Oh, man. I mean, we're hearing just a torrent of misery from the American people and, you know, from the Muslim American community, of course. This is about their relatives. I've never been in a campaign, and I've run a lot of them. You know, this is my third presidential run, but I've run other campaigns too. And I've never had a campaign where people are running up to me in public, complete strangers, who are bursting out into tears and hugging me because they are so grateful to be heard and to be defended and, you know, and to have some measure of advocacy for their relatives who are being killed, who are being absolutely slaughtered. So there's that on one hand. And then on the other, it's people who are struggling to keep a roof over their heads, who are paying 50% or more of their income, you know, just to deal with the skyrocketing rents, who do not have health care, you know, people who cannot afford their medicine for diabetes and they don't have access to Medicare or anything, you know, who are swamped in student debt, who are just utterly depressed and hopeless about the future and who are just sick to death of this political system, which is, you know, bought and paid for by AIPAC and the war machine and the you know, and Wall Street and all that. So, yeah, I mean, I hear no end of people suffering. And, you know, this is why the Democrats have worked so hard to throw us off the ballot, hired their army of lawyers. We just learned like 2 days ago, an expose in Time magazine, that the Democrats are spending the equivalent of our entire budget. They are spending a seven-figure budget. They have 30 employees purely for the purpose of smearing third parties, and in particular our campaign, who they regard as their biggest threat. You know, so it's like that's what they're doing, is just trying to silence their competition instead of addressing why it is that people are walking away from them, why it is that voters, you know, Kamala Harris is so worried about swing states. Well, she could win those votes back if she simply agreed to a weapons embargo, but she won't. She would rather just smear her opposition. The fact that we have survived that and we've come out stronger than we've ever been before, with, you know, a real alliance with the Muslim American community, many of the African Americans, students, Hispanics, so many who are standing up to support our campaign now. We're emerging stronger than we have ever been, in spite of the Democrats' very concerted effort to fear campaign and smear campaign and blame and shame voters. We're going really strong. And when they launch their fear campaigns, they're ridiculed. They're absolutely ridiculed. AOC or Jamie Harrison, you know, Angela Rye on The Breakfast Club. They're absolutely ridiculed by their pathetic rerun of the same old smears. So they're in pretty desperate straits right now. And I think this is really a time for us lefties to be getting together and looking at how we can build solidarity coming out of this and, you know, use all the power out there. This is the perfect storm, and it's going to keep getting more perfect, unfortunately, because, you know, billionaires have doubled their wealth and child poverty has tripled. And that's kind of like a sign of the times and where we are. So It's a really great time for us to be standing up and fighting for a political power right now.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you get asked this all the time in a really disingenuous way. But, you know, the Democrats will say if they lose tonight to Trump or tomorrow, whenever we find out results, they're going to turn around. We know what they're going to do. They're going to turn around and they'll say, well, Jill Stein, the Green Party, refused to get out of the way, and therefore this is their fault. So I want to give you the opportunity to respond to what I think is a very entitled anti-democratic position to have. Nonetheless, we hear it repeated not just by Democratic politicians and their leadership, but also by the corporate media apparatus. So what is your response to that talking point?
You know, what can I say? We've been through this many times before, so many times that I think it begins to lose traction. You know, and all the fear campaigning that's going on around this, I think, loses traction. In fact, let me say, I've heard from Hispanics who've discovered our campaign and who come running to our events and then say they are so excited to hear that they have this option that actually treats immigrants with respect and with dignity and, you know, would basically offer a pathway to citizenship for everybody, and that treats the migration problem, you know, the most important solution is to stop causing the migration crisis in the first place. So Hispanics are like overjoyed to hear about this. And this young woman was then saying, well, I'm going to go back and tell all my friends because they're all voting for Trump. I said, well, why are they voting for Trump? To which she says, they're voting for Trump because it's Biden who has actually been deporting all the Hispanics in the same way that it was Obama was the previous deporter in chief. So, you know, the smear campaigns are just not getting traction. And likewise, Angela Ray, who went completely ballistic on Breaking Points and was, you know, just throwing all those smear campaigns against us to look at what did the viewers think? Well, the viewers thought it was totally pathetic, that it was just an assault on basic democracy, and that they were going to go out and vote for our campaign now, having intended not to vote at all. So I'd say the smears backfire. You know, if you want to know, like, what is our response? Because this is like the only question that mainstream media asks us. And so what we say is that this is self-serving propaganda. People shouldn't listen to it for a minute. You own your vote. The politicians who tell you that they own your vote, they don't even deserve consideration of your vote if that's their attitude. You know, they have to earn your vote. If they haven't, then, you know, just forget them. So there are so many answers to this. It's just pure BS. And their intention is to just silence voters and to fear campaign and smear campaign. They could address the crisis here based on which people are walking away. But they don't actually address the material conditions of people's lives. They could implement a weapons embargo right now, and Kamala Harris would probably do very well in the swing states if she did that, but she doesn't want to do that. She would rather lose the election than end the genocide and her service to Bibi Netanyahu. So they could fix this. They could speak to a $25 an hour minimum wage. They could implement rent control across the country and actually build social housing. We call for 15 million units. There are just, these problems are solvable. The problems are not the problem. The problem is that our political system is predatory. This is end-stage capitalism and end-stage oligarchy. It has no intention of meeting your needs. So its days are over, which is why it has to silence its competition, because it actually cannot compete in the realm of ideas and policy and solutions.
Well, you know, Joe, let me ask you this last 4 or 5 minutes we have with you here. I think a big issue in the election is the time scale of terrible things that could happen. We saw what happened with Hurricane Helene. We saw what happened with Hurricane Milton. I mean, how important is it that we make a serious course correction on climate change, which is not something being talked about by the two major parties?
Exactly. In fact, Kamala Harris is bragging about how she, you know, open the floodgates to more fracking by being the deciding vote on the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, which is supposed to be a climate bill. It's not a climate bill. It's a total fossil fuels bill. Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely terrifying. And, you know, when you talk about the timeline, these, you know, dramatic, powerful hurricanes are not only super powered, they're also super fast. And they develop, you know, in the blink of an eye. The worst hurricane on record took place the year before in Acapulco, Mexico, where it went from a non-entity, it was not even like a recognized storm, to a Category 5 hurricane in the course of 5 days. I'm sorry, in the course of 1 day, in the course of 24 hours, it went to the most extreme category of hurricane. That's where we are now, where we will not even be able to evacuate when the hurricanes are coming. And we did not have money even to sponsor FEMA to do the rescues, which still need to be done in Western North Carolina. The money's not there for FEMA. This $8 billion they were short they were instead giving to Israel in order to reward Israel for having expanded the war now into the West Bank and into Lebanon. And we're on the verge. I mean, talk about scary things here, not only on climate, but also we're on the verge of being dragged into a major war with Iran, which has been Netanyahu's goal here for a long time. And, we just sent some B-52 bombers and other aircraft. We've had two aircraft carrier battle groups, one stationed off of Iran, another stationed off of the west coast of Gaza. You know, we have boots on the ground, not only 40,000 soldiers in the Middle East, but also, you know, these 5,000 soldiers with each of these battleship groups and 100 going in to provide this this missile defense. And the Biden-Harris White House has promised boots on the ground if they're needed. The draft is back. People are being registered for the draft. If you're between the ages of 18 and 25 and you're a male, you are being signed up for the draft without your permission and without your knowledge. AI is doing that. And all that has to happen is for Joe Biden to say, okay, they need us now. And if there's a full-scale war with Iran, Israel can't fight that war. You know, Israel is trying to draft the religious Orthodox Jews right now, and they're not coming. They are not a part of this. And they could decide, oh, we really need your help now, America. So America could be paying in blood sooner than you could possibly imagine, which is why this election is so critical, not only to end the genocide, but to prevent World War III, to prevent the draft, to prevent the climate crisis, which is, it's not only the storms, it's the Colorado River, which is running dry, which means we don't have the fruits and vegetables for half the nation coming from California. So there are just 1,000 ways that we're in a meltdown right now, and it's not even being discussed. This is why we have to build an alternative politics, not only in this election, but coming out of this election. And on that score, I feel like we have won. We've won because we're
Jill, I've got Katie Halper here with me who wants to break in, ask you a question. Katie, go ahead.
Great. Hi, thanks so much. Hi, Dr. Stein. I want to know, you mentioned that Kamala Harris could easily gain popular support with an arms embargo. So what's stopping her? Why isn't she doing that?
Yeah, I think she's a wholly owned subsidiary, or shall we say fully owned subsidiary of corporate America, of APAC. Does Kamala Harris think for herself? I mean, it'd be really hard to believe that. Kamala Harris seems to be an empty suit who basically, you know, puts her finger in the air. And she's hearing from a lot of Zionists and her big donors. She has more billionaire donors than any other campaign on record. She's been raising money hand over fist. So it's just not conceivable that she is not seeking to fulfill her obligation as a big fundraiser. That seems to be about as far as her brain will stretch. So it's just hard to imagine her not standing up. You know, she called for the most lethal army in the history of the world. You know, this is where she measures success. This is what she understands as the power that she is acquiring. So it's absolutely terrifying for an empty suit like Kamala Harris to be in the White House. And when people ask me, you know, and they're really trying today to get me to commit, you know, to which candidate is the greater evil, to which I have to say, I'm terrified of both of them. And they both give us reason to build as fast as we possibly can to, you know, create a political alternative. And I think we need to do like France, you know, which is to bring together the parties of the left and find ways that we can collaborate, which we've done a little bit in this race, but we need to do much more. You know, I think it's time for that. And when we do that, you know, we totally pull the rug out from under the right wing. And there's nothing, you know, when people say, well, the Democrats are the solution to the right wing extremists. No, they're not at all. They're a major driver of right wing extremism. Democrats fund the most extremist Republicans in the primaries. They spent over $50 million doing that in the last midterms. And they fund extremist candidates that they think will be easiest to beat in the general. Usually that's true, but in the process, they have basically given new political life to really radical right-wing Republicans. and the Democrats' agenda of austerity, privatization, big tax giveaways to the wealthy, and endless war. That is what creates the incredible economic insecurity and misery, which is really driving, driving the electorate to the right. Economic insecurity, you know, really is the driving force of fascism and right-wing extremism. So,
indeed.
You know.
Well, Dr. Jill Stein, as always, it was great to have you with us. It looks like you got a very exciting watch party yourself there behind you. Wish you good luck this evening, and thanks again for joining us here on Breakthrough News.
Great. Great to be with you, and I'll talk to you again soon. Thanks so much. Take care. Good luck tonight to all
Thank
of
you.
Us.
Thank you. We have our next guest on, who's also at her watch party for her campaign, so I don't want any campaign managers getting mad at me for not appropriately following the time limits of these candidates who are very graciously offering us their time. Claudia De La Cruz, who is the presidential candidate, the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Thank you so much for joining us here on Breakthrough News.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, great to have you here. You know, let me start off with this. I mean, you know, this campaign in the last couple of weeks has been, from my point of view, you know, just a lot of hate-filled rhetoric from all sides. Immigrants getting extremely scapegoated. You cannot watch any sporting event with without an anti-trans ad coming from the Trump community, Trump campaign. It's so much of negative pitting people against each other, but you focus your campaign very much on uniting people as opposed to stressing the various differences that it seems like a lot of the other two candidates work on. Why is that?
I mean, I think it's important to raise that the divide isn't between the Republicans and the Democrats. The real divide in this country is between a minority ruling class that imposes itself on the majority of people. And so it's a battle between the ruling class and working class people. And that's what we need to be focusing in. What the Democrats and Republicans do very well is create scapegoats. They start scapegoating immigrants, scapegoating Black men voters, scapegoating trans community, like everything and anything they could potentially think of is what they utilize to not assume responsibility for their deficiencies. And as a campaign, as socialists, we have the responsibility of revealing what the real nature of this capitalist system is.
Rania?
Sorry, you guys, I'm playing the unmuting game. We all know I fail at this, so this is going to happen repeatedly.
Seems like you got a lot of chatting there going from side to side. Maybe we need some security around you so people will not be talking to you as this goes on.
It's not that, we got to shut up the whole watch party. Claudia, I'm coming to you from Dearborn, Michigan, which is home to the largest Arab American population in the country. People here are, you know, really paying attention to this election, I think more than Arabs have ever before, because obviously of the genocide in Gaza and the ongoing horrific escalation in Lebanon and Yemen and across the region, potential war with Iran. And so I'm just curious, after a year of you specifically being very much a part of the movement for Palestinian liberation and being in the streets, as well as being a part of a presidential third party campaign, how has the genocide in Gaza, do you think, shifted the political landscape among voters in the U.S.?
Incredibly. It has incredibly shifted the political landscape. I think we should really take into account that if the Democrats wanted to win, they could have. They could have actually had more votes if they actually listened to the hundreds of thousands of people that took the streets and have taken the streets for over a year to demand a ceasefire, to demand an arms embargo. They could have picked up the phone and ended this genocide many months ago. And so I think it has in many ways shifted the political landscape, because it has also shifted the consciousness of people. People have gained a better understanding of the brutality, the genocidal nature of the system, and the ways in which AIPAC and other PACs intervene in politics so that working class people, people's concern in general, are not heard. And so I feel like, yes, of course, it has played a huge part. And I think it will continue to play a huge part, because I want to believe that this mass movement that has reemerged in many ways has gained a level of consciousness that is an anti-imperialist consciousness. And that could only grow more as the United States continues to finance the expansion of war in the Middle East and the expansion of war across the globe.
Claudia, one of the things that I think many people have noted about the campaign that you all have run in the PSL is both yourself and Karina Garcia, your vice presidential candidate, are moms. And this has been a big election, talking a lot about families, talking a lot about the cost of living crisis. Just talk about, you know, from your point of view, at a time where you've got, you know, roughly 155 million people in this country are, you know, having at least some trouble making it week to week. 21 million people are at least sometimes going hungry week to week. We've seen child poverty skyrocket, all these different things. People are talking about, you know, how can families make it in this reality? What do you say to people who you meet, you know, even people without families who are really struggling to make ends meet?
Well, capitalism will never allow us to make ends meet. Capitalism will always push us to be in a rat race, will always push us to fight against each other and not fight against those billionaires, those corporations, those Wall Street bankers that are the ones that are causing the extreme and deep economic crises that we're facing. I mean, you're talking about, as a mom, I could say that the groceries that I used to buy a year ago have doubled, tripled in price. And to see a government that has the potential, that has all the economic and political power to actually stop price gouging and not do that, it's very revealing. When you see that minimum wage in this country has not been raised since 2009, it's still $7.25. And we're experiencing high levels of inflation that are hitting the working class people in a historic ways, I would dare say. And the ruling class, those who have economic and political power, are doing nothing about it. And then they turn around and tell us that somehow if we give them another opportunity, they will do it better. I mean, they're playing us for fools. And I think it's important for us to understand it. All these billionaires that are running behind the Harris campaign saying, you know, as a mother, you know, you had Beyonce the other day, you had Michelle Obama, you know, all of these folks that are billionaires that have immense amount of wealth wanting to talk about what they see Kamala can do for us or not. Kamala is not going to do anything for us because ultimately her alliance is not for working class mothers. We see the cases of truancy against Black and brown mothers in California, the dismantling of families through the continuous attacks on immigration and immigrants. And so these people could care less about our well-being, about the state of our families. Capitalism hates working class families, and we need to take that really seriously.
You know, Claudia, I think a really important point to wrap on as we have you here, if that's the point we're wrapping on, but at least the last question I get to ask you, is, you know, obviously today's election day. At some point very, very soon, either we're going to find out that Trump or Harris is our next president. But obviously we know that the fight does not stop there. All of this wasn't just for election day, right? It is about building something beyond that. And no matter who's in charge, we know that a lot is not going to change. It's going to stay the same in a really bad way, and things are going to get worse. So I guess my question for you is, can you address that issue of what do we do next? No matter who gets elected, what should we be looking to do next?
Well, I think they've given us some sort of hints in terms of what communities are going to be mostly attacked. We know that they're going to continue to expand war in the Middle East. So we know that there is a continued extermination campaign against the Palestinian people, the Yemenis, the Lebanese people, and Iran. We know that they're going to continue to heighten their attacks on immigrant communities. We know that they're going to continue to attack workers by busting the possibility of folks unionizing. So we know this. And so our task is to be able to prepare to defend, prepare to protect, because the Democrats concede. Our task as people of the working class, as revolutionaries, as socialists, is to defend and protect our people, is to demand what we know is not only possible, but is urgent. And so we need to organize. We've been focusing on the need of building political organization all throughout our campaign, the need to be able to build unions if you're a worker, to be able to build student organizations if you're a student, the need to be able to build community organizations, to join political organizations like the Party for Socialism and Liberation that are fighting every day of the year and that understand that the elections are simply a small part of our larger political strategy. And so we are urging folks to get organized because we know that if Trump wins, we're going to lose. And we know that if Harris wins, we're going to lose. And the only way we win is if we fight.
Yes. Well, I think that that's certainly a time-honored piece. And I think that's a question that a lot of people are asking themselves as you're raising it is, you know, what can you do beyond just voting? And I think that you put that in a very good context and circumstance. Well, Claudia De La Cruz, I know you are also, even though it's not, you're in a nice quiet room. Thank you for that. You are at a watch party of many, many of your supporters. I even heard from your team that it was packed there. So I don't want to hold you. I know that they want to take their photos and chat and all those different pieces. So we appreciate you breaking away from your very enthusiastic associates to join us here on Breakthrough News.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Katie Halper, I want to just throw something at you right away here. You know, when you came in and we were talking, you mentioned the issue of World War III and avoiding nuclear war in different pieces. And, you know, I want to just read you something here because the New York Times recently did a poll of African-Americans, but you'll see the point I'm getting to here. 71% of the Black respondents under 30. So like young Black people, demographic, the Democrats are really going after. They're bringing out, you know, Beyonce, all these other people, Meg Thee Stallion. 71% of them said that they thought, quote, we should pay less attention to problems overseas and concentrate on problems here at home. And I want to get your take on that just because I think when we talk about Gaza, you know, I think people mainly see that as a progressive issue. But outside of that, you know, Ukraine, other issues around war, a lot of times if you're raising anti-war concerns, you're sort of just tagged as like a right winger. But I think we can assume that the 71% of Black people under 30 are, you know, leaning a little bit more to the left. And it just feels like the sort of, you know, progressive concerns about war and militarism are being written out of the mainstream conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think we definitely see this attempt, or, you know, people like to talk about the red-brown alliance, mm-hmm. as if the fact that if you have a certain view that's held by other people, and it's often for totally different reasons, like that should taint the view. I mean, that's a ridiculous thing. They tried to do that with Bernie and Trump, right? With TPP, not to sound like a total nerd historian, but with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, right? They tried to say, oh, look, Trump's against it. So the fact that Bernie's against it shows that they're both the same right-wing populace. But no, I think that, you know, these concerns are part of the reason they need to be framed and dismissed as American first isolationism is because people know full well that if you care about human beings and also you care about your own well-being, you neither want other people to be killed on your dime and you also don't want your own needs to be neglected for the sake of, I mean, it's not, I don't want to like present it as international domestic things as this zero sum game, but it certainly is striking when you see people prioritize killing people in other countries over feeding, sheltering, housing, educating their own.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm not surprised that, of course, and you hear Kamala talk about this, she and Liz Cheney talk about this dangerous isolationism as if you need to be an isolationist to not want little kids to be blown into bits. And
well, it's historically,
I mean, that's one of the scary things about seeing this neocon, neolib marriage. Yeah.
And I just have to say quickly, it's historically just fake what Liz Cheney said. She said that Pearl Harbor happened because of isolationism, which is just false. Pearl Harbor happened because right. Japan assumed the United States was going to intervene in its colonial enterprises. So the opposite of isolationism, but that's neither here nor there. Rania, go ahead.
Well, you're saying she's ignorant or lying? Shame on you, Eugene.
It just blows me away. And this is going to be my theme throughout the night because I'm just like, my head is full of so much loss, you guys. Like, today, the Israelis bombed this area of Lebanon called Manjah. And it's been a safe area because it's a majority Sunni area. But a lot of displaced people from Shia areas in South Lebanon have fled there. And actually, one of my really close friends, her 80% of her family is in this area called Manjah, displaced there. Another one of my friends, most of his family is in this area called Manjah. Israel's been doing this thing where they're actually bombing specifically residential buildings full of displaced Lebanese people, Lebanese Shias mostly, who have fled to so-called safer areas. They've been literally hunting the displaced to try to turn what they believe is Hezbollah's base population against them. And every day, this is what I hear. Like, my friend is messaging me, freaking out. Oh my God, they bombed where 80% of my family has fled to. What the hell am I going to do? Where else are they going to go next? Like, and everyone's scared. Luckily, nobody died. They killed upwards of 15 people. It's like, I can't wrap my head around how this has become normal. And then to hear the conversation in the U.S. be one where Democrats accuse anybody who doesn't want to spend money doing what I just described, arming Israel to bomb displaced people, people they have displaced because they're literally blowing up their villages, to call that America first nationalism, that's dying, that doesn't exist. But to just reduce it to that is just so disgusting, because people, actual people who have children, who have families, who have lives, who have dreams, who have homes, just like we do, their lives are being shattered and destroyed, and their families are being scattered around the world. So anyways, I just wanted to throw that personal touch in there, because again, my entire visit here has been one full of personal nightmares and horror stories that nobody in this world should have to endure.
Yeah. So people are being sort of split into all these different ways, where they're being told that every issue is black and white, but I feel the issues hit you in so many different types of ways. And one thing about one candidate can be good. Another thing about another candidate can be good or bad or whatever. And you're given this Faustian bargain over and over again. And I think that's one of the challenges to elections. And I think what turns people off a lot of times, you know, we think about 40% of people who won't vote, is it's too hard to parse all these different things. And it's hard to see, you know, how their lives are really going to get any, you know, better, I think, so to speak. So, I mean, so many of these different issues, it's not a zero-sum game. And I think you actually said that earlier, Katie, it's not a zero-sum game. And I think the media especially, wants to make everything black and white.
Right. And pit people against each other, right? I mean, we're seeing that in a lot of the way that the election is being covered, both on traditional media and on social media, which is, instead of understanding people's pain and their reluctance to vote for someone, instead of being mad at Democrats for putting these people in that position, they're blaming the people who don't want to vote for someone who blew up their people's baby. I mean, their family's relatives. And you know, I think that, like, again, people have different ideas about who, and I don't think anyone really thinks of or can see this as electing a good person. I think you can make various arguments about you can make a lesser evil, or maybe you can't make a lesser evil. You can even argue about that, right? But what's certain, I think, is that anyone who I see crapping on people who say that they can't vote for Harris, I'd ask them to, especially if they're Jewish, I just thought of this before, but like, would they be crapping on Jewish people who said that they would refuse to vote for someone overseeing a genocide of Jews? And again, you can make a calculation over whether you think that would be the right thing to do or not. But I would suggest that a lot of people would not be calling these people idiots, or would not be maligning them, that they'd at least understand where that was coming from.
I think we have a guest that is waiting with us here.
Yes, we do. Okay.
Brianna
so
Joy Gray,
the
journalist, is with us. She's many superlatives. Yay, I could list.
Yes.
With Brianna, host of the Bad Faith Podcast.
I'll go ahead and listen.
Hostess with the mostest, since we're talking about
the
superlatives.
Hi, Brid.
Brianna, hey, guys.
Brianna Joy. We've got Brianna Joy.
How are you?
Bad Faith Podcast.
Bad Faith
Podcast. It is good to see you.
Indeed.
Sorry it's so loud where I am.
Oh,
the
no,
last time I had Brianna Joy Gray on my show, she was wearing not one, not two, but three Jill Stein hats.
Hey, I've got one within arm's distance if you really want me to.
Never
Brianna,
never
leave Brianna, I am so excited. I am so excited to have you on, because you have been all over the place. I saw you on AJ Up Front with Mark Lamont Hill, and you did excellent in a debate about voting third party. And you have been a really strong advocate, not just this election cycle, but repeatedly, about the importance of breaking the two-party stronghold by forming third parties in this country. And before I actually want to, before I get your response to this, I want to play a clip. I know you've already seen it, but I did this focus group while I was here of Arab Americans, who everybody's been talking about who they're going to vote for. I got people of a variety of perspectives. And Brianna, what was so interesting is it was like pulling teeth to find a single person in Michigan who's Arab American, who was willing to go on the record and publicly say, they will be voting for Kamala Harris. So our focus group was all third party voters, a couple undecideds, and actually two Trump supporters in the Arab American community. But I do want to play a clip from that of those 30 party voters. Can we play that for Brianna?
We don't even exist on the list when it comes for the American government. They care about Israelis, not us. So when we choose to vote, we don't choose to vote because, oh, we don't see how the American government have hands on that. It's because depends on what goal we're trying to achieve. When I speak to people in Lebanon and they tell me, Misha, can you make sure you don't mobilize the community to vote for Trump? I'm like, I'm not doing that. But why? Can I know why? They're like, because he wants to expand. We just want to finish. I'm like, so what do you think we should do? I listen to my people in back in Lebanon. I don't just listen to the same emotions that we all know about it, and we don't need nobody to remind us about it. No one have the right to do that. No one have the right to dictate our lived story and re-traumatized. And generational trauma we pass it on to our kids. Like, truly, is that what we're trying to educate ourselves about? Like, F women's rights when our own woman is struggling, losing their babies in bags. We know that we're being betrayed by the Democratic Party. But
yeah. So actually, that's somebody who interesting. Sorry, that was actually the wrong clip. I was going to play the third party clip as well. We can do that. But she actually was one of the people who, she works inside the Democratic Party, and she refused to say if she endorsed Kamala or not. She was still undecided, but she was still seemed to be struggling because she feels her own community is upset with her for still working inside that party. And we can go back to the third party clip, but I guess, Brianna, I want to ask you, as we're on election day now, you know, what is your response to the way that this has been covered? I mean, you did a really good segment about John Oliver, basically using this woman in South Carolina, a Democratic Palestinian-American woman, I believe, who endorsed Kamala, but is a bit of a Democratic operative, to say that because she said that, we should all endorse Kamala over Trump.
The Georgia representative.
Exactly. Yes. And look, John Oliver, I think many of us have enjoyed his, you know, lighthearted work over the years, but it's for that reason, I think, particularly disappointing to see him sort of leverage one woman's political choices to sort of launder his own desire to defeat Trump. And as he says in the clip, basically go back to brunch, not have to think of him anymore, especially when Rua's politics are not at all representative of what polls suggest is the norm within the Arab American community, and what also your own interview suggests and anecdotal evidence suggests. So I actually use clips from that really amazing panel you put together, Rania, to help to illustrate this point. I used them to kind of provide some anecdotal context, but also remember the CARE poll from just a few days ago, which shows that more Arab and Muslim American voters, I think it's actually Muslim American voters, are choosing Jill Stein than Kamala Harris. The numbers are close, but Jill Stein eked out slightly ahead. So to then pretend as though finding Rua and having her sort of opinion stand in for the all is deeply disingenuous. We also have a little bit of information that's just come out. I've seen on the timeline. There is a vote tally from one majority Arab American Muslim precinct in East Dearborn, Michigan. The leader in that tally is Donald Trump with 203 votes. Right behind him with Jill Stein is 153 votes. Kamala Harris is down at 59 votes. So Jill Stein got almost three times as many votes as Kamala Harris. Donald Trump is a bit ahead of Jill Stein. But what we're really seeing is that Kamala Harris is nowhere in this conversation, at least for this precinct that we have numbers for in Dearborn, Michigan, which of course has a large Arab American population.
Listen, Brianna, I hate to cut this short, but I love that you got to come on and respond to that. I appreciate you so much, and I want everybody the amazing monologue you've been doing. I've seen that you've been back to your monologue.
The debriefs,
which I love just as much, if not even more, than what you used to do at the Hill. So thank you so much, Brianna, for everything you do. Brianna Joy Gray. Bad Face podcast. We appreciate and we'll all be watching you.
All right. Thanks to you both. Take care.
Bye, Brianna. Bye, Bri.
Thank you, Brianna.
I think we actually have our next guest sitting with us, so I won't do too much editorializing, but we can come back around it and give you guys an update. There's not too much to update you on so far. Saul Williams, well-known poet, thank you so much for joining us here on Breakthrough News.
It's a pleasure to be here with you guys. It truly is on such a crazy night.
Yes, I mean, an unbelievable night. I mean, there's so much to say, so much we still don't know as we're waiting to see how things play out. You know, one thing I wanted to just start by asking you with here is just the way the election is framed for us. You know, I mean, a lot of people were talking, for instance, about, you know, Kamala's town hall on CNN when she was asked about Palestine and basically said, I will do nothing other than continue with the genocide. But I know you also care about grocery prices, as if the two things are mutually exclusive. You know, the same thing with even just the Trump versus Kamala, like you only have two. I mean, it just feels like the way the election is framed is in and of itself has this just, I don't know what to say, just odious nature to it.
Well, it does have an odious nature to it. And you know, I think the Democrats have made a hell of a dangerous gamble by essentially, you know, waving the banner of anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian hate, you know, and Kamala doubling down on her support of Zionism and of, you know, Israel and what have you. And at the same time, they're fighting Trump, right? And what we've been saying, I mean, because they've also gone against protesters and what have you, and what we've been saying is, we're all in this together. And the only way that we defeat fascism, the only way that we defeat racism is together. And if you're going to splinter off and, in fact, go and side with people that we actually, a lot of us identify as racist, you have less of a chance of winning. So there's something sad because I don't know if they carefully weighed the actual weight of anti-Blackness in this country, you know, when you think of the possibilities of Trump winning, you know. And so the way that this thing has been framed is completely disingenuous. It's forced people, you know, not to weigh the price of groceries over the price of Palestinian lives, actually, but to actually weigh their own consciousness and try to dismiss their own conscience, you know, when they know that something happening is wrong. And when they have all of the polls that have said that the majority of your constituency wants an arms embargo, the majority of your constituency has wanted a ceasefire. And so to go against the grain of their people and believe that they'll be able to win new people and still be able to win without counting us in, it's just dangerous. It's dangerous. This election should not be close, actually.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to keep moving forward, but we were really, really honored to have you here with us. Poet Saul Williams, thank you so much thank for you. Joining us.
I appreciate you both so much. I'm so appreciative of your voices. I'm a preacher's kid, too. And love you both. All right.
Love it.
Right on.
Love
it. Thank you so much. Oh, man. Well, Katie Halper, welcome back with us. Let me just throw something at you here in terms of, you know, perceptions of the election. Obviously, one of the biggest issues that people are bringing in is the cost of living crisis. And one of the aspects of this has been the conversation about whether or not things are improving, whether they're not improving vis-a-vis inflation and how that could affect either of the candidates. But just to give you a sense, in October, you had average wages rose about 4%. Also year on year from the year before. So 4% from October 2024 to October 2023. The same cost, the cost of housing, of shelter, increased 5%. So the cost of your rent or your mortgage went up 1% more than your wages. Food away from home went up about 4% as well. Electricity went up about 4% as well. So your wages went up 4%, but your rent went up 1% more than that. Your electricity went up just about as much as your wages. And so did the cost of going out and having your friend, going out with your friends and trying to have a good time to get away from all the stress. I mean, really just a sign, Katie, of how up against it, you know, people really are and how much that it all the economy always frames the election. But I feel like we're kind of underplaying and the media is underplaying like how difficult it is for people day to day.
Yeah. I mean, who was it? A wise woman named Hillary Clinton, I believe, was revealed when she was addressing Goldman Sachs. She said that she worried, I mean, in a candid moment, she worried that maybe it was hard for people like her with all their fortune to stay in touch with the realities of people who don't live in that circle.
And I do think that even just like cynically, I think these elites are so out of touch that they don't even know how to pander correctly. You know what I mean? Like, obviously they're not providing the right solutions, but they don't even know what to pretend that they're providing, what solutions to pretend to be providing.
No, it's a good point.
And so, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. But I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry.
No,
please. I have someone just shared with me a statistic that's totally unrelated and it's pivoting from this question. So if you want to stay on this, we can totally stay on this.
Go ahead.
A question about, well, it's funny. Speaking of, you know, the turnout, Prem Thakur, who's a great journalist. I don't know if people watch his work, but he's absolutely amazing. Always holding, I don't know how the State Department still takes his questions because he's always asking them about Israel's crimes. And he asked them about Hind Rajab, like basically like every other time he's on. But he tweeted out that in terms of the Jewish vote, I think 78% in exit polls from CNN showing that they are voting for Kamala Harris. Let's see. Yeah, for comparison, one 2020 exit poll from J Street found that 77% of Jewish people voted for Biden and 21% for Trump. 4 years later, the CNN poll has the margin the exact same, which is funny because something that Donald Trump said in one of his many moments of unhingedness, or maybe not, was he said that if he loses, it's going to be because of the Jews. I don't know if you guys heard about this. Mm-hmm. Right. And of course, because we live in the worst media environment, that story was compared by CNN. That was an example of anti-Semitic speech coming from the right. And that was compared to the anti-Semitic speech coming from the left. That was literally Rashida Tlaib criticizing the attorney general of Michigan for prosecuting student protesters. And I don't know if you guys followed this at Breakthrough News. Forgive me if you did. And I'm explaining something that you already know about. But excuse me. Basically, you had Rashida Tlaib, and this relates back to the theme of Gaza. She very rightly criticized the Michigan attorney general, Dana Nessel, of prosecuting student protesters, pointed out that there was a bias. She was not talking about a bias stemming from Nessel's identity. She was pointing out a bias that was related to the identity of the people being prosecuted, that identity being either a Palestinian or Palestinian supporting. And CNN actually, Dana Nessel actually pretended and lied and said that Rashida Tlaib had singled her out because she was Jewish. And then that claim was picked up by Jake Tapper, and then by the ADL, and then by Jewish Insider, and then again by Dana Bash. So I'm just reminded of Trump's words about that. And it's interesting that it hasn't changed at all since Gaza.
No, it's a great point. And also noted that Representative Tlaib was trying to bring attention to the fact that the Flint water crisis, that you know, these racist and pro-corporate people who had poisoned tens of thousands of Flint residents, majority Black, had never had any sort of legitimate accountability whatsoever. And that got totally wiped out of the story. And they were like, oh, she's, you know, making this anti-Semitic attack on the AG of Michigan. And it's like, no, she's making a point about how they won't go after racists who are who are poisoning Black children, but they will go after college students who are protesting against the genocide.
Right, exactly. And honestly, like that guy, she's a Democrat and this guy is a Republican, Rick Snyder. You'd think that she would maybe want to go after him, but I guess the corporate circle jerk is so strong that she won't even go after him. So she tanked that prosecution of Rick Snyder, the Michigan governor. But anyway.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, let's move forward here in the show to a critical issue. We've already obviously been tracking it, and that is abortion rights. We've heard from three of the states so far where there are a number of referendums up, I think maybe 10 at all. But we're going to get all the details and all the relevant context from our next guest, Jessica Mason-Piccolo, who's a senior vice president and executive editor at Rewire News. Jessica, as always, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back.
Well, it's always great to have you here. And I mean, there's a lot of issues that I want to touch on in regards to this. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of referendums that are out tonight regarding, you know, abortion rights. I might argue the right to have the appropriate health care you deserve. But one I just want to start with here quickly for people to understand. So in Florida, there was a loss, but it's partially because of the way Florida is structured, because 57% of voters have said that they do support abortion rights and they want it codified in Florida. So what happened there, just so people understand?
Yeah, thank you for letting us start with Florida, because it is in any other context, but Florida would be a win that reproductive rights and justice advocates would be celebrating for years to come. And that is that abortion rights and restoring Roe, which was effectively the top line of the amendment there, received nearly 60% of the electorate. And so ballot initiatives are managed differently state by state. And Republicans in Florida had very successfully pushed for the 60% threshold. Interestingly, Republicans in Ohio had pushed for a similar threshold, and that was defeated. Which was one of the reasons why Ohio saw a successful ballot initiative to restore abortion rights, but Florida did not. And so even though we have an electorate where, I mean, my first television appearance was 2000 as Florida flipped. And so from there, the Florida elections have gone increasingly conservative. And yet abortion got damn near 60% of the votes in. And at a time when the DeSantis campaign was running nothing short of a full state authoritarian attack on its supporters, sending state police out to folks who had signed the petition to support getting the matter on the ballot to begin with, threatening local news stations for airing ads in support of it that resulted in court decisions. I mean, this was a pretty clear 2025 playbook in terms of how conservatives plan to run against abortion rights advocates. And so we got a good trial balloon in there. But I do really want to underscore that the message that folks should take away is, even in deeply conservative and increasingly so Florida, bodily autonomy is very popular.
I wanted to ask you about why the threshold to pass ballot initiatives is so high in Florida. Is that typical?
It's typical in states that fear voter direct participation. And so, I mean, I'll let the viewers make their own conclusions there. But truly, when states have been effectively gerrymandered and voters respond by trying to initiate ballot initiatives, we see a response to create additional hurdles to having those initiatives placed on the ballot to begin with.
Yeah, I think it's an important question. And we saw the same thing with the issue of felon rights in Florida and how that played out.
Yeah.
We have had the wins in New York and Maryland. Now, I know a number of the other referendums are further out west, Nebraska, mm-hmm. where there's dueling referendums, Colorado. Maybe just give us a scene setter, if you will, of what people should be looking for, what amendments are up and things that are relevant about them.
Proposition 1 in New York is really important and was one that was not even necessarily a clear win for abortion rights advocates. And Proposition 1 is effectively a mini equal rights amendment. And what it does is protect gender against gender discrimination broadly. And that includes pregnancy outcomes. And there was a lot of infighting around the New York campaign. There was concerns about the fact that the ballot initiative didn't say the word abortion and that would create confusion. There was a really, what I would say, aggressive anti-trans campaign against the ballot initiative in upstate New York. And yet still, despite very little advertising, I mean, from my colleagues who were in New York City, many said that, you know, their friends didn't even have any understanding that it was on the ballot or on the election this time around at all. That still did very well. So I think that there are going to be a lot of lessons for there. I mean, I think one of the things we will see coming out of all of the 10 states, no matter if it is a 9-to-1 ratio with Florida as the outlier, or if there are other states that struggle to pass initiatives as well, is that the blueprint for restoring reproductive rights is not going to be a one-size-fits-all solution. And that is probably a good lesson for reproductive rights advocates to learn sooner rather than later. And it is then a necessary shift into a reproductive justice framework, which should have happened a long time ago. But I think that will be one of the top lines as we look back 3, 4, 5 days from the ballot counting now, which is, it is important to restore access, but there is not a one size fits all approach that is going to do it. And what works in Florida or doesn't work in Florida is not going to be the same thing as Missouri or New York or even here in Colorado, where we have abortion on the ballot as well.
So we would all agree that Republicans are abysmal on this issue of reproductive,
yes,
of reproductive justice, as you framed it. So, but what do Dems need to do more of, and what have they failed to do that they really could still hopefully do?
Well, I think what they could do is actually really embrace reproductive freedom and autonomy with their entire chest. And again, I'll point to Florida. If Deep Red Florida has a 57% support rate for what would effectively restore Roe, and that state currently has a 6-week ban in effect, right? And now conservatives are already pushing for a total ban, right? Like that is what they will try to do next. If Deep Red Florida still shows up for 57% for abortion rights, then it is foolish to think that that is not the case, even in places like Alabama, Mississippi, and Texas and Louisiana. It's just a question of tactics at that point. And so then that is going to be listening to the folks on the ground, letting the local organizers do their business. One of the concerns around New York is that the campaign was a consultant heavy bureaucratic top-down operation. It could have cost New York and equal rights amendments. So let the people who live there and know their localities take the lead. And even then in places like Kansas, for example, or Ohio, when they do, we see success.
No, I think that's such a good point. And I mean, we've obviously seen in many different states, you know, this has been a factor in, you know, just sort of driving enthusiasm as well of people going to the polls because, you know, they see something positive that they can vote for and move forward. And I just feel like that is also an element of this, is that when we talk about where we are right now, the need to have broad coalitions that really bring people out around issues they care about and not narrow everything down to just, you know, one or two issues, as it were, but speak to people as their entire person. I think especially young people. I'm kind of rambling now, but it just feels like that is a lesson I've taken away from a lot of these ballot measures, is you feel like, okay, this brought a lot of positive energy, a lot of young people, people who maybe don't care that much about politics, that we actually can really engage people just beyond the horse race if we really start speaking to the core of these issues with actual solutions.
And they want to be engaged. You know, my oldest is a sophomore in college, and this was his first presidential election voting in, and he and his cohorts were excited to participate. And that is great to hear, and not because of any one particular issue, but because they sort of understood the moment. And they are split on a lot of things. I think that will be another lesson that we see coming out of this election, is coalition building is real and needs to happen, because this idea of a big tent will just carry candidates that tent has frayed so significantly that, you know, and we've learned that an overinvestment in top heavy national races does nothing but leave places that need investments in locality, that need actual money and candidacies, like they're left twisting in the wind. And that is no longer a viable, I mean, it never was, but it is especially in my issue set, not a viable strategy after Dobbs.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this real quickly. Sorry, Katie, to jump in, but something you just said, Jessica, really stuck with me. And that's actually the impact on just healthcare in general of what we've seen with a lot of these abortion bans in states like Idaho, I know, and others, especially in rural areas, it's had a pretty, if I'm correct, devastating impact on healthcare providers generally.
Yeah, I mean, abortion is healthcare. And when you criminalize an aspect of healthcare, there's a domino effect that goes well beyond the meme of, I didn't think the leopards would eat my face. And I'll use the example of the tragedy, the most recent tragedy out of Texas that ProPublica reported on, the 18-year-old woman who died in amid miscarriage. Reportedly, she was a supporter of Texas abortion bans, as was their family. And her mother was screaming, why will not the hospital intervene in this miscarriage? And what folks have failed to connect, thanks in large part to an excellent propaganda campaign by the anti-choice movement, is that abortion is one outcome of a pregnancy. Miscarriage is another outcome of a pregnancy. Live birth is another outcome of a pregnancy. Stillbirth is yet another outcome of a pregnancy. Pregnancy has a myriad of outcomes. And when we criminalize one, we endanger them all.
Right. Yeah, that's so important because people, like you were saying, the anti-choice movement, which is more, that gives it more kind of grassroots credit than it deserves. But the anti-choice agenda business really does like to divide and conquer, like you said, and make it seem like reproductive health is something and reproductive justice is something people only need to worry about if they're going to terminate a pregnancy.
Right. And I mean, we see it in very tactical ways, too. Their entire effort to redefine healthcare so that it does not include abortion, to erase abortion out of statutory language. That's not just because they're weirdos fixated on something. There is a very strategic reason behind it. And there's a rhetorical reason behind it as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's such a crucial point. Well, listen, Rewire News is on top of all of this, and you are the Senior Vice President and Executive Editor at Rewire News. Hopefully people are checking you out. If you're not, I don't know what you're doing. But as always, Jessica, we really appreciate you joining us and helping us sort through it all here on Breakthrough News.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure. We've been through it for a while now.
We sure have. Oh, man, right on. We'll keep fighting. Thank you so much, as always.
Great meeting you.
Yeah, talk soon.
Excellent.
Great to meet you.
Bye.
Yeah.
Yeah. That story is just heartbreaking about that woman who literally was killed. I mean, it's just so disgusting. It shouldn't have to matter what the person was doing or wanted to do with their pregnancy. But, you know, this was a person who happened to not be seeking to terminate. It was a miscarriage. And because of these draconian anti-abortion, anti-choice laws, was killed because of that, was killed unnecessarily because of sepsis that she didn't have to endure had people not been afraid of being prosecuted under these draconian misogynist laws. So that was an awful, awful story. I just wanted to point out, by the way, something that I was looking at the Arab American Institute, which is great. Yeah. They do really great polling. And it's really important to remember that, again, sorry about my voice, but it's not just a majority of Harris voters, but a majority, a small one, but 51% of Trump voters say it is very or somewhat important that the United States demand an immediate ceasefire in Lebanon and Gaza. So it's just a good reminder of how bipartisan not only the political elite consensus is, but how bipartisanly out of touch the elite political consensus is, because it really is a departure, does not reflect what people on the ground want. And it's not just Democrats, it's also Republicans who want that.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.